To start off with today, guys, I would like us to go to 2 Thessalonians 2, and we're going to read verses 1 to 4, just to give us a little bit of context, particularly for those of you who haven't looked at the lesson. We can then hopefully be a little bit on the same page. So the lesson's called The Great Apostasy. It could have been, also could have been probably equally as accurately called The Falling Away.
So 2 Thessalonians.
That
2 Thessalonians 2, verses 1 to 4. 2 Thessalonians
yes.
2, verses 1 to 4. All right. Who would like to read that one?
Me.
Go for it, Zach.
Now, dear brothers... is it 2 to 4?
2 verses 1 to 4.
Don't be so easily shaken or alarmed by those who say that the day of the Lord has already begun. Don't believe them, even if they claim to have a spiritual vision, a revelation, or letter supposedly from us. Don't be fooled by what they say, for that day will not come until there is a great rebellion against God and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the one who brings destruction. He will exalt himself and defy everything that people can call God and every object of worship. He will even sit in the temple of God, claiming that he himself is God.
What version are you using?
New Living Translation.
Yeah.
Which one? The New Living Translation.
Ah, okay.
So it basically just
expands
it.
It's a bit more modernized. All right, cool. So in that passage, we see a few elements that were discussed in the lesson if you had a chance to look at the lesson this week. So it says, we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and by our gathering together, that you be not soon shaken in mind, or be troubled neither by spirit nor by word nor by letter as far as from us, as that the day of Christ is at hand. So he's basically warning them that there's going to be a bit of a process of shaking up going on in the church, right? And then in verse 3, he kind of gives you a little bit more of a descriptive of how that shaking up is going to occur. He says, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. So he says that there's going to be a process by which people are going to try to deceive. About what specifically, did you notice?
God's second coming.
Yeah, but what element of that?
Man.
Someone claiming to be God?
No. It's actually that the coming had already taken place, or was taking place, or something like that. Because he says, notice there in verse 3, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except this happened first. So basically the deception is going to be trying to get them to think that it will come or that it has come without the deception taking place. Do you get that point there from verse 3?
But if it has come, then why
are we still here?
Well,
that's the whole argument.
So there's a lot of different elements to it, Lil, but basically some people believe that there's a spiritual coming. Then some other people believe in this rapture idea, but... Either way, let's leave that bit alone for now and focus on what Paul is saying, and that is that there was going to be a falling away. Or what did your version say? A great rebellion, was it?
Against God and rebellion. The man of lawlessness.
Yeah. And then it says in verse 4, it describes this man of sin or man of lawlessness, that it says he opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he, as God, sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. So the great deception is going to be one whereby a man, like you guys were saying, would sit in the place of God.
The Antichrist. Is that what this is called?
Sure, let's just label it. Whatever, but let's just read the passage, eh? It doesn't say the word Antichrist in the passage.
Yeah, but isn't that what it sounds like?
Yeah, that's what John would call it, but we're reading Paul. You get the difference, John and Paul? So Paul says that there's going to be a falling away, right?
John Paul.
John Paul.
Isn't that a person?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yes, Pope John Paul, yeah.
Good one, Kristen.
All right, so...
That's just one half of four people.
All right, so Paul says, let no man deceive you, because there must first become this falling away, right? This falling away must take place. So let's talk about that falling away, or what the lesson is entitled, The Great Apostasy, and how that takes place. Just chirp in wherever you feel you want to chirp in, Nato.
But I'll probably put it right at the beginning.
Okay, go for it then.
Okay, so over the last few lessons, yes, we've talked about what God's kingdom, what it's based on. So what is God's kingdom based on?
Love.
Love, relational self-giving, creation and inclusiveness.
Mm. Yeah, we can do that.
And Satan has rebelled, yeah, and set up an opposing, we might call it confederacy or dictatorship, based on what?
Selfish? I mean,
yeah,
selfish. Basically the opposite.
Yeah.
So selfishness, pride, hate, deceit, and taking. So Satan can't create, therefore he tries to take what God has created. And this has happened ever since before the world was created. But could Satan use sheer force to get what he wanted?
Depends. If he can make you feel like he's using sheer force.
But can he use sheer force?
No, not
really.
Why not?
Because
he doesn't have the power.
Yeah, he doesn't have the power. He's not God.
Oh, okay, so there's his weakness.
So God is more powerful right now. So how does Satan get what he wants?
By putting thoughts into our minds and making us believe them.
He tries to manipulate us.
Make us believe them.
Refer back to what his kingdom is based on. What's his kingdom based on?
Deceit.
Hate.
Lies.
Lies. Deceit. Hate. Pride.
Everything opposed to God.
So,
yep.
He uses, he plays on something that is foundational to the a loving relationship, which is freedom of choice. That's what he plays on. Because in God's kingdom, freedom of choice is a founding principle. It's a founding principle of love. Satan uses this and mixes in some deception to try and either get people to think that his way is more fun or better, and so as to choose his way, or to drag down God's character and what God gives to make that look worse than what he's got to offer. So he plays on that to get what he wants. Because Satan can't offer anything better than what God does.
But he makes it look like it's better.
Yeah.
Now, what is one of the most successful deceptions that he uses?
Appetite?
No. Technology?
Your weakness?
I want to get a hint. I want like a
hint.
Poor friend kind of thing.
friend.
Yeah.
Perhaps... this would remind you, Gold.
Is that American?
If you refer back a little while, back when
that is American.
Yeah. Back when the junior teams were combined.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Refer way back to then.
What's the
fancy word for it?
Pseudo. No.
Counterfeit.
Counterfeit.
That's
it. I remember
he
that.
He uses counterfeit.
I do.
Counterfeiting. Now, what is counterfeiting? It is copying
the original, but it is
but
different.
It doesn't have the value. So, Satan copies what God has made, but it doesn't have the same value as what.
Isn't there
God
a city in America that is known as the counterfeiting city?
This has happened throughout history. But then fast forward to the early church, when God had set that up, or rather re-established his church based on what? Based on
love,
relational self-giving, etc. And it started gaining popularity, and it was spreading like wildfire across the world. Now, at this point, we might have a slight intuition with what that other question, that first question.
The first question that I asked in the email, is that what you were referring to? Which was? Remind me.
How did Jesus re-establish his true church when he came?
Hint, hint. First section in the lesson.
Hint. Alright, that's
second.
I'll stop giving hints.
Yeah.
His self-giving and non-coercive love. Thank you. I highlighted that.
Yep.
She's ready.
In the verse it quoted there from Luke 22, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, he who governs as he who serves. And then up in the next section, it said, somewhere here, I remember reading it.
Which one?
I don't know where you read it.
Page 2, about halfway down, or a third of the way down. Finally, Jesus voluntarily submitted himself to the violent rage of those whom he came to serve, thus giving the zenith revelation, that means the greatest level, the ultimate revelation of God's character and kingdom. What is sometimes called the myth of redemptive violence is the notion that responding to violence with violence will end the violence. By dying on the cross, Jesus set in motion the only principle of action capable of stopping the cycle of violence, self-sacrificing, non-violent love, which only returns good for evil. And so the upside-down kingdom that we were describing in the lesson here was, he demonstrated a power under rather than a power over method of governance. I think you can see the difference there. So Jesus' power was in his servanthood, right? As he was to empower people by serving them from beneath, if you like, he lifted people up. Whereas when we have the power over model, if he had have just been a commanding king, then what happens when you exert power over somebody?
They don't like you.
Well, potentially, yeah. But you're not empowering the person, right? You're just commanding the person, and so you get a servant out of them. Whereas if you are a servant to them, you empower them to be the best version of themselves. Yeah.
So Christ set up his church by giving rather than
commanding,
by taking.
Yeah.
So Christ establishes church, or re-establishes church based on love, relational, self-giving.
Which, by the way, is, you will understand by nature, is completely contradictory toward everything that is within us, right? We're naturally bent towards selfishness. And so when Christ came and he introduced a kingdom that operates on a different principle, he was literally, this is why we're calling it the upside down kingdom, he was literally turning society on its head and saying, everything that you've known, that needs to be replaced with this, the complete opposite. You know, read the Sermon on the Mount if you really want to understand that well, because that's where Jesus really articulated that really clearly.
Yeah, it was spreading like wildfire, and his people saw in new light the deceptions that had held them captive, and they now had hope, joy, and peace. Satan's reign was being crushed. So what did Satan do?
He goes,
I can't have this, I'm going to try and do something.
Yeah. So I'd refer back to 2 Corinthians 2.
He once again retaliated. And guess what he did?
The 1844 confusion?
What was
he created a counterfeit.
That?
Oh, he created a counterfeit.
Is it? Oh, the Romans brought in the idol.
A counterfeit. Okay.
I give the girl a prize.
Yeah. This is where the. I'm just listening a little bit.
No, we have
more hands on. If I wanted to counterfeit American $1.
Is that a legit American $1?
That one is.
Yeah.
And so is that one. All this is. Well,
he's rich.
All American.
Jeff and I have an American $1.
That's cool.
Mm.
If you wanted to go and counterfeit it, what would you do? Would you go, I'm going to make a note that looks like that?
What?
Would anybody be...
Is that American? No.
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 Indonesian. Would anybody be fooled?
No.
No.
No. Because it's obvious. Like.
So what would you do?
You'd replicate
it. You'd scan it and print it.
You would try and make it so that it's as close as it's possible. Now,
but
Satan doesn't want
different.
It exactly the same. He wants to put a little
works.
Bit different in there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But he wants to make it so that it's maybe indistinguishable, at least at first. So, okay, so this is real, but let's just imagine that there was a little bit different on that one. Would you pick it up at first glance?
No.
Yes.
No. That one's old, that one's new.
Pick it up.
But, if over time, counterfeit got spread, and then just bit by bit you just start changing a bit more, a bit more on it, a bit more on it. Those changes, they start to become accepted as normal.
Mm-hmm.
And bit by bit, it may actually, over time, change to something that is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone might know it as being legit, but it's not. Because over time, it has been changed little bit by little bit by little bit until it is something completely different. And if you put the two side by side again, it would be obvious. But because it's been a little bit by little bit, it has been gradually accepted and accepted and accepted to the point where none of its original characteristics are the same.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what happened to the church.
So, for example, if
the
Church of Rome, if they had of just come out, you know, straight away and produced this myth of redemptive violence, so to speak, and gone on their conquests to, you know, Christianize nations by force, if they had of just done that straight off the bat, do you think the followers of Jesus would have been like, oh yeah, I'll get in on this? Because that looks like what Jesus was establishing.
Of course
not. No, so what they had to do was they had to meet Christianity where Christianity was and just slowly, like Nada was just pointing out with the note there, change it little bit by little
you
bit.
You know, that sounds really creepy because that's kind of what God does as well. He meets us where we are and then he changes us little bit by little bit.
Oh, that's creepy.
His character.
But is that changing it into a counterfeit or into
it's
a
real thing?
It's a counterfeit changing.
It's going,
oh,
that's a counterfeit. I'm going to change that.
Just change it the wrong way.
But you can't replicate you.
Oh.
That's the thing,
yeah.
though. Like, when God works on your heart, he's not trying to create another you because there's going to be something not going to be another you.
It's a better you.
Yeah.
No, that was just the thought that I had when you said
what is what he's doing is exchanging
he's a dumb dude
something that is worthless into something that has its original value.
Yeah. But sin does it the other way.
So the way this actually happened in history was in the establishment of the church. So you had you know, Christ setting up the church, the New Testament, you know, Christians spreading like wildfire, like Nato said earlier, because they were operating on the principles that we talked about last week, you know, and that church was actually attractive. And then they started to do was they started to say, oh, well, this is excellent. Why don't we introduce this into, you know, the mainstream culture or elements of the mainstream culture into the church? And so they slowly but surely corrupted the church by introducing these little bits and pieces to the point where, you know, they actually changed the day of worship because they're like, oh, no, we want to honor Christ and the resurrection. And because they had incrementally done this, the people were like, oh yeah, that sounds like a good idea. We'll you know, worship on a Sunday to honor the resurrection. And so it's like, yeah, no worries. And so little bit by little bit, and then they finally got to the place, you know, by these, you know, imperceivable changes, they got to the place where they were actually, you know, the conquistadors were going in and they were like, yeah, we'll you know, make this into a Christian nation, and if you don't, you know, bow to our God, we will kill you. And then you have that period that we're going to talk more about next week, which was known as the Dark Ages.
Is that next week?
Yes,
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, we're going to talk about
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but notice how this, you know, Paul talked about it being a falling away, and it was a falling away from what? From God. But specifically what NATO was talking about was
the real thing.
Yeah, which was
God's law.
No, yep, that's right. God's law, which was a representation of his character, which was selfless love, right? And so it was a falling away from that being the foundational principle of the church. That everything revolved around the fact that God was love, and his call for us was to live in selfless love, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And so then as they fell away from that, to use Paul's expression, then what naturally results when you fall away from that? You're going to become more and more...
selfish.
Yeah, corrupted in selfishness and... And I thought your word earlier was actually a really good one, manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really good way to look at it. You know, when you're manipulating something, when you're manipulating a Play-Doh, you're doing it by these small, imperceptive sort of movements to the point where it eventually becomes... If you just tug on the Play-Doh, what happens? It breaks, right? You know, the structure doesn't hold together. But if you manipulate it, you can get it to that place eventually where it will be long. You know, like I was just sort of illustrating by ripping it. So manipulation is probably a very good word. And so, yeah, Paul explains that this falling away would happen by the personage being self-exalting there in verse 4 of 2 Thessalonians 2, remember? He was going to exalt himself, you know, in the place of God. And then, yeah, it talked in the lesson about this idea of from verse 7, actually, which we didn't go to, talks about the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. You're familiar with that language? The mystery of lawlessness. So this power that was exalting himself above God eventually took away the law, which, again, what is the law all about?
Love.
That's right. The law is an expression of God's love, which, if we follow it, we are giving him an expression of
our love.
Our love, right? And so by taking away that law, you're taking away selfless love. And so this is what was going on in this lawlessness idea. I like the way they wrote it in the lesson. The coming apostasy would be characterized by lawlessness or anomia, which means against law or without law, referring to God's law of self-sacrificing love. So that we would be without self-sacrificing love. That's what was going on. So it slowly but surely got to that place where there was a man in place of God representing his own agendas in place of God's agendas. And that power in Daniel 7 was called? The little horn power.
Oh, yeah, I know. The kingdoms, because the little horn destroyed three other kingdoms.
It did uproot other kingdoms. So who can give us like a very brief synopsis of Daniel chapter 7,
the
prophecy?
Is this the one with the four beasts?
It is.
Yeah.
The lion, the bear, the leopard, and
the
eagle.
Let Chris do the synopsis.
Okay, I think... So there was this whole great big storm thing, and the winds and the seas were like, you know, really crazy and stuff.
Yeah.
And then out of the sea there comes these four beasts. One of the beasts was a lion with wings. Another one of the beasts... was a, I can't remember.
Yeah,
you have to do it. I can't
here.
Do it.
Right here.
Fine.
Second beast was a bear.
Third beast was a leopard with wings. And the fourth beast was a really, really, really bad looking beast.
Yeah, the leopard not only just had wings, it had
four wings. Fine teeth and everything.
Extra fast. So extra fast. Extra like.
Yeah. All right. So there's these four beasts, right? And without going into all the details of the prophecy, the four beasts represented four kingdoms, the same four kingdoms as were represented in the first vision of Daniel in Daniel chapter 2, with the big metal man. You remember the head of gold represented Babylon. The chest and arms of silver represented.
Oh yes.
Persia.
Persia.
Daniel chapter 2.
And then the belly and thighs of bronze represented
Greece.
And then the legs of iron.
Nebuchadnezzar's dream. This
okay.
is Nebuchadnezzar's dream.
And then so Daniel 7 represents those same four kingdoms using different symbolism. And so you'll notice this in the prophecies, in Daniel in particular.
Oh, they're the same thing.
You'll notice that what happens is you've got this element, and then in the next prophecy it expands on the same elements. And then in the next prophecy, it expands on the same elements. And so we call it the repeat and enlarge principle, right? So Daniel, there's this repetition of the same sort of history of time, passage of time, but it's, every time it's repeated, it's like, have you seen those anatomy books where you can get like the skeletal system and that's like the base structure. And then you can overlay
with the muscle.
Yeah.
With all of the other systems.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right? You've seen those overlays? It's kind of like that's what happens in the book of Daniel, right? You've got Daniel chapter 2, which is kind of like the skeletal system, if you like, of prophecy. And then he overlays that in Daniel chapter 7 with these four beasts. And then in Daniel chapter 8, you've got the goat and the...
Ram,
yep. And
one
and they're
the other.
Clashing. And so you've got, you know, another enlargement on that. And then in the latter part of Daniel 8, you've got the 2300 days. And then Daniel chapter 9, you've got the prophecy of the time period where Jesus is specifically referred to. And then in Daniel chapter 11, it's like crazy detailed, the whole thing. And so then in Daniel chapter 12, just goes up a little bit further. And so it's like this overlay is occurring, right?
Yeah.
Not overwhelming.
So why is there this vision that Daniel got from that the angel helped in?
So I'm not actually going to answer that question right now because we don't have time. All right, but the little horn happens to become coming out of the fourth beast, right? That dreadful beast, which represented in the time prophecies, which was the fourth beast representing
the
kingdom of Rome, right? And so the kingdom of Rome, out of the kingdom of Rome comes this little horn. Now, what does a horn represent in prophecy?
A kingdom.
A power, yeah. A kingdom or a power, right? And so you've got this power that raises up out of Rome, right? And so we're going to make the application without doing all the homework because hopefully you've done that in your lesson and hopefully you already know it because you're mostly Adventists.
It's like a prerequisite.
Right? And so the little horn power represents out of coming out of pagan Rome comes papal Rome.
Papal
right?
Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so this falling away that Paul spoke of is actually synonymous with this little horn power, right? Because as the church fell away, what came out of like this pure church of the apostolic times was this little horn power that rose up, and it then brought the pagan Rome, the principles of pagan Rome, combined Christianity with that, and now you've got this pagan Christian nation power.
Pagan Christian.
Yeah, it really is. and that rises up and calls itself the universal church. That's what Catholic means, universal, right? And so the Roman Catholic state and church represents, in their minds, this is Christianity now, right? And then we're going to talk next week about what happened in that period that we call the Dark Ages and how that this is Christianity power, you know, expressed its Christianity, and it wasn't very nice, let's put it that way. So, but the principles, the characteristics that the lesson drew for this little horn power as the characteristics that sort of characterized the kingdom.
It
were,
spoke against the Most High.
Read it in your lesson. They were, somebody want to pull them out?
Self-exaltation,
force
and violence in God's name, against God's law.
Okay. So,
sounds like Satan.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? And can you see that from the passage we read in 2 Thessalonians? Can you see the similarities there? Self-exaltation was in the passage, wasn't it? Yeah? That's right. Force and violence in God's name is something that's an extension of that. And then against God's law, I just pointed that out to you, was in further along in the passage where we didn't get to in verse 7 of 2 Thessalonians. And so Paul, when he's warning the church, he's basically saying, go back and read Daniel. Right? Go back and read Daniel. And then later, John is in, you know, on the island of Patmos, where we're going to be, you know, learning about in the sermon today. And he's given all these really wacky visions, right? And in those visions, God is basically saying, you remember that stuff I told you in the book of Daniel? Here's some more information about the same stuff, right? And so these elements, though, of self-exaltation, force and violence in God's name, and being against God's law, were characterizing this kingdom, this apostasy. But let's bring it back to something that's going to be relatable for you, because I don't know about you, but do you find yourself like wanting to exalt yourself in the place of God?
Kind of not.
Kind of not.
Control God. Like, I want you to do this, please.
Yeah, good point. And we're going to come back to that because that's going to be a really practical application. What about force and violence in God's name? Is that something you struggle with on a day-to-day basis? Probably not so much, right? You know, nobody here has the power of Pope. I don't think so. Yeah, and what about being against God's law? Like, are you guys active proponents of the fact that God's law was done away with? You're trying to convert your friends at school that, you know, not to go and read God's law? No, not relevant, right? So let's talk about the relevant parts of these three elements in our lives today. How is this apostasy seeking to infiltrate your life, your walk with God? You mentioned self-exaltation and the desire to sometimes tell God what to do.
Yeah. We aren't allowed God to have control. It's like we tell him what to do and then like say, you better do it.
We're not supposed to demand. We ask if it's his will.
That's the point. Yeah. So basically what you're saying is sometimes we try to tell God how to run the universe.
Yeah.
And we're not quite happy when he doesn't run it the way we wanted him to run it.
Yeah, I wonder why.
Yeah. So, but that really is harping back to the very beginning of the lesson when we talked about the upside down kingdom. That's because your desires aren't in line with the upside down kingdom naturally, are they? Right? And so we're going to naturally find ourselves wanting to exalt ourselves above what God says, in the sense that we're going to find ourselves willing our own will in place of God's will. Yeah?
When sometimes we try and do what is commonly known as Bible bashing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, no, I'm right. Here's the proof.
Let
me
whack
it over the head.
Yep. That's a good example of how we can sometimes do force and violence in God's name. Also, we mentioned it before, but this idea of the myth of redemptive violence, do you kind of understand what that's about?
It's like...
Fire.
It's like Superman, right? So how does Superman do the good?
He punches people
so that they don't punch each other.
That's right. It's like every movie you could ever watch today that comes out of Hollywood is going to be, the hero of the movie is going to be bigger and stronger and better than the people who he's conquering, right? So we're taught to think that the person who is the good person is the one that fights better than the bad people and saves the, you know, innocent people, right?
That is actually
but Jesus,
for God, but he doesn't actively do
Jesus
that.
But Jesus didn't fight.
Jesus introduces a whole new way of doing it, though, right? When Jesus came to the earth, he didn't go, you know what, I'm more powerful than you, Satan. I'm just going to wipe you out. No, Jesus came and he let Satan kill him. He gave himself willingly for the sake of well, for our sake, right?
Freedom of choice.
Yeah, so in our minds, we are kind of pre-programmed, because thanks to Hollywood and thanks also to our human nature, to think that violence makes things right, right? But Jesus is saying to us, no, it doesn't. So do you ever feel tempted to be frustrated?
Yeah.
And angry?
Definitely.
Yes.
And maybe sometimes, maybe sometimes you raise your voice.
Yep, certainly.
Yep.
Well,
okay.
And
how
lesson.
Do you deal with little siblings who won't listen?
Hey, you've only got one.
Well,
totally get you, John.
Yeah,
well,
but if me and Kristen are both annoyed at one person, then how powerful do you think that person is?
How do you deal with annoying parents?
Okay.
Do you kind of see the point, though?
We
this is what we're saying is the myth of redemptive violence is that that's the right way to deal with the situation, that you just raise your voice even louder than the other person. Right? But that doesn't solve the problem, does it? What do you want to say, Gracie?
Oh, no, because it says in the lesson on page 2, in the third fourth paragraph, like how you were saying about the good guy always overpowers everyone else, but it says that self-sacrifice triumphs over force. Greatness is humility, elevation is service, power is love.
Hmm.
So that's basically, like, the complete opposite of what the world depicts as, you know, greatness.
The
hero.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
The hero.
So we need to surrender our will to God's will so that we're not self-exalting ourselves, right? And then that will flow over to the second point, which was force and violence in God's name. If we're submitting our will to God's will, then we're not gonna follow our human nature, which says, I will make this right by means of my power. We'll use God's method, which is to serve. And then the third one, being against God's law. How do you see this working itself out in your everyday life? Okay, like we mentioned, maybe you're not going and propagating the lies of Satan's kingdom actively, but what are we doing that is sometimes doing the exact same thing?
Sinning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hypocritical actions, right? They say the same thing about God's law as if we were actually preaching it, yeah? And, you know, guilty as charged, all of us, yeah? And so we actually do struggle with the apostasy, but it happens to be happening within us, right? And so just like Nathaniel was bringing out with his object lesson, the changes to that counterfeit bill happen incrementally, right? Very, very small changes that are so imperceptible that you don't even know what's going on, right? And so ultimately...
You won't know what hit you.
Yeah, and so ultimately what the devil is trying to do is he's trying to manipulate us to the point where we will become something completely different than the character of Jesus and the kingdom of Jesus, yeah? So how do we fix that problem? And this comes back to your point before, Chris, about how that God's method is actually quite the same. So Satan seeks to manipulate us by, you know, little by little changing us into his image, whereas God does the same thing but from the opposite perspective, yeah? He seeks to mold us back into his image. But he doesn't manipulate us in the sense of, you know, deception and coercion and those sort of principles that Satan uses. God uses what?
Truth. And love.
Yeah.
Like the bottom manipulates
clay. Yeah, like that verse, 2 Corinthians 5, verse 14. His love compels us. The love of Christ compels or constrains us.
It's like it, as if we had the Play-Doh or whatever made with a lot of iron filings in it. Now, you can force it to into a shape or whatever by manually doing it. That's like what Satan does. What God does is like having a magnet, and it's the attraction of the Play-Doh that moves the Play-Doh. The attraction to the magnet. It's not a you must do this, it's a Play-Doh goes, I like that.
The Play-Doh.
I want to go that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, also with like God's love, with like, it also, like with the lesson, it was talking about like John 13 and how it said that, you know, Jesus, even though Jesus knew that he was going, who was going to betray him, when it was going to happen, he still like loved the people who were in the world who were going to do that to him, and he loved them to the end. And that's like really like mind-blowing, because like he still loved the people who he knew was going to kill them. Like, if we knew that someone was going to kill us, we probably wouldn't love them, we'd probably resent them.
Yep. Probably do all that we could to stop them. Yeah. So just really quickly before we close, I just wanted to close out on the last page's point. So I think it's really important. And that basically that boils down to this passage here. It says, a religious system that darkens the character of God by teachings that make him appear exacting, cruel, and coercive can only have the effect of generating either slavish fear or outright rebellion against God in human hearts. And skipping down a little bit, none of us are better than the rest of us. We're all inclined to self-exaltation and disinclined to humility. God loves every member of the human race, and Jesus died for all. While the system is warned against as dangerous, the people are cherished by God as precious objects of his love. And so I think it's really important that we all remember that, yes, there is a system, this pagan Christian nation, or this pagan Christian power that has expressed itself in the Roman Catholic system. But there is a Romanism within all of us, right? This apostasy that we're just pointing out that dwells within us, the very same principles that the Bible points out as being the problem with the Roman Church exist within us. And so it's really important that we don't look down on anybody else as worse than we are, but that we all seek to extinguish the Romanism that is within us. Does that make sense? So the idea that Paul is trying to get across in the passage is, don't be deceived. There will be a falling away. Don't be part of the falling away. Yeah? Don't be a part of that falling away yourself. And when we get to later on, when we start talking the three angels' message, and we talk about Babylon being fallen, we need to get people out of Babylon, out of Babylon, yeah? The challenge with that is Babylon exists within us, right? Within our carnal nature. And so we need to come out of Babylon, or Babylon needs to come out of us, is probably a more accurate expression, before we can help anybody else, right? And it's not just about getting them out of the system. It's about getting the system out of them and getting the system out of us. So just be really careful that we don't label anybody else as better than or worse than.
It talked about Jesus said, I think it was Jesus, he said, don't bother with trying to get the speck out of your brother's eye, but because you can't see past the plank in your own eye.
Yeah. Awesome. All right, let's pray really quickly as we close. Father, thank you so much, Lord, that you have warned us of what was coming. Thank you that you have given us every opportunity not to be deceived by the counterfeit. And now, Father, as we go out today, I pray that you'd help us to each see the apostasy that exists within our own hearts. And Lord, to give it over to you, that you would extinguish it from us, that we would be able to be part of the pure church that you are creating, that will sustain your message through the end of time. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.